Hey guys, welcome to the Cinepile Podcast, the podcast for films that matter. It's been a hot minute since we came back, but we're going to be coming in hot with episode 15 discussing adventure films. We're going to be talking about some classics, some new films, and overall really having a big arcing discussion about what matters most significantly about adventure films and what that crops up. Kyle, kick it off here.
This is a special episode. I love adventure films.
You love adventure films. You turned it. This was your idea.
You're an adventurer.
The new film from James Gray that it's been out for a couple weeks now, and that film is The Lost City of Z.
You are the explorer. Give me a hand.
I wish to find a lost city.
What you seek is far greater than you ever imagined. It is your destiny.
And I think all of us can agree that it was, dare I say, masterful.
It's daring to say, but you might be right.
I would say, first starting off, it certainly was a movie that belonged in the theaters. That was definitely appreciative. So, because I mean, it takes place in the Amazon forest. You know, it scales, you know, large geographies from, you know, beautiful greenscapes of England to World War I France to the Battle of Somme to the Amazon and all the dangers that lie within that. And it was a film that kind of harkened back to the broadness and the breadth that was like almost a classic film. And it was great in that regard.
Yeah. So it does belong in a theater because it's beholden to a cinematic tradition. It kept itself to that. And so we wanted to kind of discuss it through the lens of another film, which we chose the absolute classic, Lawrence of Arabia.
The English have a great hunger for desolate places. They hunger for Arabia. I think you are another of these desert-loving English.
Have you no fear, English?
My fear is my concern.
We need a miracle.
They hope to gain their freedom. I'm going to give it to them.
The man who gives victory in battle is prized beyond every other man.
It's going to be fun.
Now, both of the films have a couple things in common. They both, for one, shot on film. Lawrence being 65mm, Lost City of Z being 35mm, and both of them went to location.
Yeah,
and
huge.
I think those are two rules that they followed that is like a cinematic tradition right there.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, because I didn't know that at first with Lost City of Z that they had filmed it in the Amazon jungle. Like I was telling you guys before, like when there was just a tracking shot or something like that, I was like, someone had to set up a dolly track in the jungle with mosquitoes and like just getting
I didn't even think about mosquitoes.
Like getting it there. Yeah, mosquitoes are like the size of dogs, you know, and just like just getting it there and
they
just
actually
the
went
appreciation.
Through the journey
yeah.
that they did in the film.
I bet, honestly, if there's a Blu-ray that comes out and has like behind the scenes, that'd be really something to check out there. But
didn't quite go Herzog on it, but they did go to the jungle.
No, yeah.
And
like
you
this,
can tell.
People, you know, people talked a lot about The Revenant when that came out and how the difficulty of going in and shooting on location and bringing all the gear to do these elaborate setups and stuff. No one's talking about Lost City of Z. I think I enjoyed it more than I did Revenant.
Really?
And I loved Revenant.
Yeah, Revenant's good.
Before we dive too deep into like the films, though, I think the interesting question that we brought up initially to do the episode was, what is an adventure film? Why are we doing an adventure film?
How to categorize
How do we scale that down for a discussion and not have every film? What could you argue is an adventure film?
Well, when you Google it, yeah, you get results like Finding Nemo, The Big Six, which is the original Star Wars trilogy and then Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah.
Those are considered adventure films. Mm-hmm. For me, that does not fit my definition of an adventure film, even though it is an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
To me, at least for the sake of this discussion, and when I think about adventure films, it's movies like Lost City of Z, Lawrence of Arabia, real men going through or real women. Suffering.
Yeah.
Or women. Like, I just watched Tracks. I would call that an adventure film. It's about a woman who decided to cross the Australian desert.
I've seen that.
She trains camels. It's a true story. She had a Nat Geo photographer following her. I would definitely call that an adventure film.
I saw that like a year ago. That movie, because I saw you were watching it, and you're like, I'm watching Tracks. I'm like, why does that sound so familiar? Yeah, I watched that exact movie. Yeah, it was really cool. I liked that movie a lot. But kind of go back to what you were saying, that, I mean, you can see Frodo going to Mordor. That's great. But at the same time, it just loses, I don't know. I feel like an adventure film has to inspire, and when it's a true-to-life story, it has that inspirational bit. Like, to talk about shortly about Lawrence of Arabia, at one point he was just like, how old are you? And he's like, 27. And that just made it all the more captivating, because I actually knew that he was a person younger than I am who was doing these great big things that made him as a character more captivating. And I think the character also for Percy Fawcett from Lost City of Z was just amazing too, because he was a real guy just hacking his way through Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
We're bringing up an interesting point where it's like, is everything that we've even been considering so far an adventure film based on real life? Like, what's, because you just brought up Tracks, that's based on real life.
Mm-hmm.
We have Lost City of Z, we have Lawrence of Arabia, all of them based on real stories of people. It almost, not that that's a prerequisite, but it's like, there's some tangible realness to it that like,
because mm-hmm.
for one, I think in our, I can't speak for everyone necessarily, but what I think for an adventure film, it has to be journeying into the unknown, almost for the sake of the unknown, either because you're looking to discover something or it's like self-exploration or something. Like,
right. Yeah, they're going to find
something. It's not a survival film where you are trapped somewhere and you're surviving the elements necessarily. I mean, in an adventure, you're doing that. But yeah. That's not the reason you're out there. You're not out there against your will.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You are going out there on your own
to test volition. Yourself. Yeah.
Does Revenant qualify then?
No.
Cooper says no. I'm on the fence. I definitely think it's got those aspects. I mean, it's based on a true story. The man went through incredible lengths.
It's funny because
for revenge and survival.
Because I almost don't. It's like ironic that I almost don't want to call it an adventure film more than. And this sounds stupid, but almost more like an odyssey, in that it has some kind of like phantasm to it, like some kind of like fantastical element. But I mean, if it really was true to life, and they did keep it as it truly was, and as far as what the
no, and none of these films
doesn't
do.
Need to be necessarily true to life or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would say is, you bringing this up right after the quote I just said, it makes me question what I just said, which was, okay, well, are they journeying out in here for the sake of the journey?
That's what I'm saying.
That is not Revenant.
No, it's not.
That is not Revenant at all, right? So
they're out there to get beaver
pellets. I don't
know.
You could definitely argue, and you know, this was a thing that we talked about too. Is like, okay, well. Do I really care what the definition of an adventure film is? Almost feel like a lot of the discussion
I think it's like what adventure necessarily... films are preferred. So the adventure is the main character and the main plot almost in a way. Star Wars, there's an adventure that happens along while they're doing some other things. In Lord of the Rings, same kind of thing. Like they're exploring that, but I feel like a part of the adventure was wanting to actually journey into this one place specifically. You know, it wasn't like to destroy a ring. It wasn't to, you know, get to some point. It was actually about discovery and about like finding something.
So what about Up?
Oh, Up totally is a harrowing adventure film.
obviously it's animated, but it is about the journey. Or the discovery of like, you know, going out there, right? Mm-hmm. It's an animated one.
I actually would count Up as an adventure film.
For the sake of comparison for this episode,
right?
Maybe not so much, but mm-hmm. I could put that easily in the adventure category.
Yeah.
It's like, I've just been on a tangent reading these true to life.
Shackleton.
Or if not true to life, things like The Way Back, the Peter Weir film. It's loosely based on a true thing that people went through, and they made up a bunch of fictional characters to deal with that, to deal with the escape and the survivalism aspects. But I just... For me, I want something real with an adventure film.
I mean, so yeah, regardless, we're talking about like what is an adventure film. At the end of the day, we're you know, splitting hairs. We can talk about it forever. But it's a fun thing to talk about, and you can do it with every genre, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think
it's academic, though. It's not getting to the heart of the matter.
Right. It's a discussion worth having with friends, I think. You know?
It's probably not the best.
Define your terms, sir.
Yeah.
You know, like one of those.
But
let's dive into some more technicalities.
Yeah, so of the two.
What made those movies shine?
Okay, so something that I have that I think we wanted to talk about was the similarities, I think, of adventure films of pacing.
At least these two films, we don't want to speak too broadly, but these two films, man, the pacing sold it for me.
Well, maybe I should say an ideal adventure film.
For me, these two films, are like the ideal pacing.
It's the pacing
of an adventure film.
It takes the time it needs.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. They're both long movies. Lawrence of Arabia, especially. It's like two movies.
Mm. It is.
And even it's thematically. Like 4 hours long. Even thematically, it's like two movies.
Yeah.
Lost City of Z clocks in at like 2 hours, 40 minutes, something like that. And a lot of people, I think it'll get negative reviews, and it has for that length.
Yeah.
I love it. I eat it right up.
Well, and
I think it adds to the realism of it a little bit too.
For sure.
And granted, like that is spanning a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Lost City of Z, much more than Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, it's Percy Fawcett's entire adult life, mm-hmm. basically.
And pursuing this mysterious city that, well, at first he's just going to Amazonia
as a cartographer.
As a cartographer, and then he finds some archaeological information, and then he discovers more and more and more, and it becomes his passion in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, the first time he's kind of going, not that it's against his will. He would have never done this.
It's
had
not,
he not
a mission.
Been pushed do it.
Absolutely.
Well, it's a mission assigned to him.
Yeah, it's not a mission he would have chosen.
Right. It's an assign, and he does. You know, he discovers the. I guess that was probably the moment he wanted to keep going, is when he discovered the pottery or the idols or whatever in the middle of the forest, that he was like, okay, whoa, this kind of changed his opinion.
And that's a great parallel between the two as well, because, you know, Percy dreamt of restoring his family name. He dreamt of grand adventure, like that he's read in his books this entire time. Lawrence was a cartographer and of low standing, and what Percy was a quartermaster in some garrison in Ireland that was a know-nothing person. And so they were both reaching for greater ideals, and I thought that was a pretty common parallel towards men who have adventurous spirit, or women who have adventurous spirit, who come from humble beginnings that are kind of overlooked, that get put in this really outstanding environment, but they get put in this outstanding environment because they're kind of replaceable, and it makes them remarkable.
Yeah, they rise above.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the diamond the pressure has turned this nothing person, you know, it's like going through the fire to become what they were. It's like a destiny. It's a hero's journey.
Yeah.
But it's real. They've like, we turn it into a bit of myth, but these people still did really exist, and they became obsessed, and we remember their names because of it.
And then as far as like, I mean, we talked about a little bit of editing there, and also just the shots, like the cinematography. Like, ooh. let's talk about the cinematography.
Well, hold on.
Okay.
One more point about the editing before we move on. Something, Lawrence of Arabia, hopefully you've seen it if you're listening. Very early on in the film, it has one of the most famous edits of all time, where Lawrence blows out the match and it hard cuts to the sunrise on this vast desert. This beautiful shot.
Mm-hmm.
That hard cut is repeated, I think, in Lost City of Z. There's something so powerful about the hard cut that matches these two images.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it a couple times in Lost City of Z, but what I really remember is there's this little trickle of whiskey racing through a sink, and it hard cuts, and all of a sudden it's a train.
Right.
Right. Well, yeah, it's like it's going from like right to left or something.
The train does the same.
The liquor going into this. It's not going down the drain. It's just like kind of rolling down the sink, and then the train matches that action.
Mm-hmm. It's like, how often do you see such a power, like it's a strong edit. That one's a little less symbolically significant, whereas like they just got through telling Lawrence that the desert is nothing but fire, and then this match blowing it out becomes the setting, which plays such an important role.
The hard cut is exactly when the momentum picks up, and to have a film recognize that edit and to use an edit in such an artistic manner is really refreshing, because it allows everything to integrate and what makes for such a good movie.
And if I could take it even a step further,
do it.
It's pure.
Whoa.
It's like the purest type of the purest edit that can be. It's like, just the hard cut.
It's like the Walter White of edits.
And it goes goes right along with like the manly explorers that were following. It's like there's no frills, there's no fanciness about it. It's just two ideas, two images cut back to back.
Okay, well, so talking about, I know you mentioned cinematography, yes. But since we're talking about pacing and editing, I think the score kind of goes more hand in hand with that.
Oh, for sure.
And both films kind of take a different approach with the score. Where Lawrence of Arabia, the score is, especially in the first part,
Baroque.
The first film of Lawrence of Arabia, part one, is the film part is almost second fiddle in some parts to the score. Mm-hmm. Like the score is lit, like in your face, like you're watching imagery to enhance the score that you're listening to.
To the point where you can't even hear if there's any sound design of the desert.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just score.
Like big orchestral. Like.
Yeah, big sweeping adventure soundtrack. Mm-hmm.
The whole thing starts on black with this like...
It's an overture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It starts with an overture.
It's like 3 minutes of black almost with just music. And you're like,
is there
something wrong with the Blu-ray? Or is there something wrong with this copy? Or what's going on here?
Yeah, that was kind of funny.
It's just classic. That's what they used to do. It gets you in the mood.
Yeah.
They created this epic orchestral soundtrack, and they're like,
it kind of primes your pumps in a way, you know, you up, gets you ready to go.
The score dictates the pacing in a way, right? Like if it's not going to be a fast cutty montage of sequence, you know, it sets the mood. Well, I guess it goes back and forth. One enhances the other.
Lost City of Z has the modern score for certain. What? It's almost present throughout all of it in a way. There are some excellent scenes without it, but I've been listening to it while I work, and it's the kind of music that you're not made to notice it.
It's way more subtle.
Far more subtle than Lawrence of Arabia. But to go back to Lawrence of Arabia, the music, which is at first so
bombastic.
Yeah, bombastic, and it's too present.
Yeah.
It's kind of berating you. Looking back on it now, I feel like it's very purposeful, because then you get to these completely musicless sequences later in the film.
Well, I think it paralleled his own spirit, to where it was when he was first going to the desert, it's when he was first seeing these beautiful mountains. They made you fall in love with the landscape and the adventure as much as Lawrence was, and I think that's why they had that, you know, that drumming that sweeping kind of like majesty. And made you fall in love with the desert. And then
you were on an adventure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You were having fun.
Yeah, and like, you know, you're seeing this in a movie theater back in the 1960s. It's on like, you know, super wide 65 millimeter film, you know, just totally badass. And, you know, this complimentary, like, you know, it was a theater experience. And they sought to make that happen, not only on a theater level, but on a character level too.
Mm-hmm.
And like how you're saying, I think it also made the silence more noteworthy through contrast. Because it brought you down to reality, to where it was like, no, this is where the desert gets flat. This is where the desert gets hot. This is where the desert gets dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's really no accident that really the first scene of conflict and, you know, worry is silent. It's completely silent when they're at the well and the stranger comes in far distance. You just see like a speck coming in through like a mirage or whatever, you know, like the heat waves, and that whole sequence is just silent.
Yeah, and it's so powerful.
It is. Yeah.
And so even though that music was kind of overbearing in the beginning, how often do you see nowadays absolute masterful use of silence in a scene of conflict, no less? The only one that comes to mind for me off the top of my head is Tarantino, where he'll have those really tension, drawn-out dialogue sequences. But this, there's almost no talking. It's just silent visuals.
I would say another good parallel would be There Will Be Blood. I think There Will Be Blood definitely used great contrast of you know, it was beautiful sunshine, you know, California, with an ominous long violin of just like, and it's like, this doesn't match anything at all, but it gave like this eerie contrasting sense to it. And that's what I thought of when I was watching it, just because it's the same kind of desert sort of situation there. But I mean, I thought the music was stellar for sure. I mean, both in Lost City of Z and for Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it plays a very important role. One of them is very modern, though. Mm-hmm. But I think Lawrence's use of silence just sets it apart.
Yeah.
It really does. Mm-hmm. Like, the absolute perfect choices. That Mirage desert shot has a little bit of trivia that I like to share.
And that'll get us into cinematography. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So they used a special 482mm lens from Panavision designed for the film. And keep in mind, this is a lens that has to fill a 65mm frame. So it's not like you go buy a 400, 500mm for your Nikon or whatever it is. No.
That's a beefy lens.
Yeah, that's like half the size of sensor or of space that it's got to fill. It's known as the David Lean lens, director David Lean's. It was created specifically for this shot, and it has not been used since. It's very rare that you have a reason to use that lens.
They wanted money shot.
Yeah. To put it simple, yeah, they wanted a money shot.
They got a money shot.
And so to do that with the lens, you know, that's just, I think it just shows craftsmanship, you know?
So here, to take it even a step further, they were looking at that image, right? They had this super long lens on it. They're cutting back and forth, which they had to be very particular about the edits in that scene, as far as his distance. So they actually painted the desert. If you go back and watch the scene, there's actually two lighter tracks that were meant to be where camels tread to and from the well that lead directly towards the Mirage.
What?
It guides your eye. I can't remember the quote right now, but David Lean, I think he said something to the extent of after the scene, he was like, "You're never going to do anything better than that." he's like, "That's the most subtle, perfect use."
Just leans in.
Of design.
You peaked, kid. You just peaked.
You can go home now.
But I'm 22. Yeah, it's not my fault.
But yeah, it's craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that kind of jumped out at anyone technically? Like music, cinematography?
Oh, well, I think we should move on to Lost City of Z cinematography. Yeah. But just a final note, it's like, the film is a classic for a reason. Every frame is just marvelous.
A tableau, if you...
The one thing I want to add too, and we can even talk about it, but their use of wide shots is really good. They have like several... where the subject of the shot is a speck. Mm-hmm. And you can see that speck clearly.
Yeah, your eyes are drawn to it.
And they hold on this just, you know, it's like just showing like the complete isolation of this speck in the middle of a desert or whatever the landscape is.
Yeah, they make the environment into a character. In both
absolutely.
Films.
Yeah.
But that wide shooting is fantastic.
Whereas Lost City of Z is like the opposite
yeah.
as far as isolation.
Super, super tight.
Tight.
Yeah.
Well, just like their surrounding is tight.
Yeah. It's claustrophobically like, tight in yes, both the shooting and the edits towards just like, and also the use of silence when they're just going down the river or something like that. And you just hear the sound design of just like a bunch of crickets, a bunch of weird frogs, bunch of jaguars lurking in the bush, and then arrows.
Natives.
But as far as, I mean, do we want to talk more about the technicals or?
The cinematography of Lost City of Z, I think just like the rest of the film, it's classic. There's not really lots of, I don't want to say there's not lots of style, but just like there's not a lot of style in a hard cut. It is what it is. I don't know if I'm being demeaning by saying that, but it's just such a classic style. It's not handheld. It's not doing anything particularly crazy or wild.
Mm-hmm. It's not drawing your attention away from what's happening in the shot.
There's a couple moments only where it's meant to bring attention to itself. The rest
it's locked off. It's framed well. Not just well, it's framed great.
Yeah.
For the most part. The color's great.
The moves are deliberate. Very deliberate.
Well, I think also because we're dealing with, you know, it's a period film. Everything is so terribly beautiful. And like, you know, from the Amazon jungle to old England to being on the train to being on the ship, you know, everything is so antiquarian and so interesting looking. And so I think like just having that complicated, like boom dolly Steadicam shot in a period film. Leave that for the old for the Sherlock movies with you know all that kind of stuff. Like if you want to make an exciting film like that, do that. But this is a film that's like you were saying, the meditative and minimalistic shooting style matches a meditative minimalistic score and editing style as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what might drive some people a little batty in the fact that it is such a slow burn, but it allows you to appreciate every single frame for what it is and allows you to really take in the image. And I think how I was saying earlier, like how Lawrence of Arabia was a theater experience and also Lost City of Z, I think that's also what made a theater experience. They shot a little bit wider. They shot beautifully. Neil, you were talking about the lighting like of the interiors and like mm-hmm. the colors of that. It makes you appreciate that on a whole level. Did you want to say anything about that?
Well, okay, so yeah, like the minimal style adds to the realism. I think if you have like these sweeping moves and these like, you know, like when they had the scene where he's like giving the speech to like all the other men about like, let's make an adventure and stuff. They don't have like a bunch of like crane moves like going through the aisle and past their heads or anything. That kind of like takes away almost from a sense of realism.
Yeah, nothing looks like a bullshit master shot. Everything looked like they knew what they were shooting for. You know what I'm saying?
You mean
saying?
Like bullshit coverage?
Yeah. Bullshit, like, you know, coverage master shots where it's just like, George's like, oh, a little dolly over here and then a girl and then like we're going to come down here. Like everything seemed intelligently crafted and designed.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost like there's a feeling of like when there's a lot of like, and I like really good camera movements myself. I mean, they're great. But like when you have something like that, that's almost the precedent. Like that's like the more important part of how they set up the shot. They're like, okay, we're going to set this shot up and we're going to make you guys work around this move or that whatever we're doing with the camera. Where when it's like the camera's locked off, it almost feels like you're just there witnessing what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like...
Right. You're a part of history.
The acting and like the people... Yeah.
The design and the blocking isn't necessarily accommodating the camera.
Exactly. It's accommodating realism or the drama that needs to happen. I mean, we could go on a tangent on that for sure.
Oh, we could. Yeah.
So the point is, it's distracting, right? When right, the style, maybe a film has already done it, or maybe a film will do it in the future where it does a period piece with the kind of like Wolf of Wall Street or Baz Luhrmann style where it's super kinetic all over the place, but I haven't seen it yet and I don't particularly want it.
Oh,
if I mean, I am on such a high with Lost City of Z, this classic adventure, deliberate pacing. I like the slow burn.
Yeah.
I like a
good slow burn.
Yeah.
Yeah. You enter into your, like, you know, your later 20s. You learn to appreciate a story that's told a little slower. You evolve from Transformers. I mean, and then you realize, hey, what's the rush, Bumblebee? Huh? What's going on?
I do want to touch on color a little bit. Just okay. A little side note. I don't want to get too deep in it.
Neil, our local colorist, kill it.
I think the most, or my favorite part of it was, he wasn't the technical colorist, but he was the head color, I guess the head supervisor of color.
Right.
Which was Peter Doyle. Big fan. He's like a super technical genius as far as color. I think he's like the head of
Kodak?
No, of Technicolor.
Oh.
For like, probably like the London branch and shit. I'm probably butchering it right now, but he's like a big guy.
Right.
He did all the, I don't know how big he actually is physically. I don't know. But he's
5'2".
He's a larger than life guy.
No.
He's a legend.
Yeah, he's a legend. He's most known for doing, he did all the Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter films. That sells him short just saying that though. Like
his resume is just epic.
He's a pioneer of coloring in the modern day for sure. Old school guy that worked, you know, he's the reason that different things get developed by like Kodak or by companies that deal with color like Baselite or something like that. Anyway, so he was the head of this. That got me excited.
Mm-hmm.
The style was pretty modern.
I was just about to say.
It was very modern.
Yeah, it's a modern color.
Yeah, palette. Yeah, it's the very Hollywood. It's not Michael Bay modern like that, but it is very like, yeah, like that steel, like cool mm-hmm. shadows. Especially when we're talking like the indoor lighting and like the indoor scenes, it's beautiful.
Yeah, masterful. There's that sequence where she's putting out the candles on the chandelier and eliminating the light off the surrounding to where it's more just her and Percy.
I love when light has to be very often window motivated, and you know, they use that haze really well to just have the just super soft, nice diffuse lighting.
And always motivated, always natural.
Yes.
Always. I wish I knew I can't remember who the actual colorist was on it. I feel bad for talking about Peter Doyle when he wasn't the technical guy that did the coloring. He was just the supervisor on it.
That's okay. That's all that matters.
it is a big deal though, for sure.
But yeah, we've talked about some of the technical aspects.
All the nerdy bits.
What's important today in our modern society, at least what's really controversial, is race. Mm-hmm. And both of these films deal heavily with issues of race. In Percy Fawcett's case, in Lost City of Z, race is the white people and the savages. And no one back in England believes his tale. It's kind of ridiculous. They don't even believe that they were capable of pottery.
Right.
He's found these remains, and he claims that there was at one point a city that could support large numbers of people.
Right.
And they think it's just insane.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually, the white people are actually threatened by this idea that somebody else could develop civilization.
Yeah, they're the only ones who have the capabilities of doing so.
Well, yeah, the whole scene is like Percy, like, talking to all of them, like giving a speech to a crowd or like a room full of well-educated
early 1900s
powerful men, and it's an argument, but it's like him versus like 100 guys that are like
just talking shit right back.
They're all just talking shit. It's like ridiculous.
It's fantastic.
No, it like honestly, at some points it was a really great scene, because to break it down, it's sort of, you know, kind of not to discredit, but it kind of was like your mama jokes almost in some way, because Percy Fawcett would have these great grandstanding things talking about the pottery shards that he found, like talking about cities, and then some gentleman nitwit would stand up and he would just have the most British-ism, you know, just like, I do say so, you remind me that of a blah 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 blah, and it was just the most like high-minded, highbrow, like, burn that you could possibly get. That was one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie.
It's a lot of fun.
It was just a burn session. I loved it. Yeah. And let's talk about the parallels of race between the two films, because Lawrence of Arabia deals with race in not only some blackface occurring a little bit later on with Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the actor who played Obi-Wan Kenobi, what's his name?
Alec Guinness,
thank you, Kyle. But also just with the relationship of the outsider, the British foreigner coming in, who's so educated, who thinks he knows everything, but he still refers to all of these individual tribes as just a one whole Arabs. And they're like, whoa, excuse me? No, we're the Hittites and the such and such and the such and such and the such and such. Don't call us all Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, motorboat your little white ass right back over across the English Channel and don't bring it to it. And so part of it becomes he assimilates himself into it and gets a greater level of understanding. And honestly, for me, I didn't know that much about World War One desert warfare. I'm not sure if a lot of people are experts on it. I'm not. And it was also eye-opening on how the British just treated the different Arab tribes during World War One, and just how they kind of fucked them over. I don't know. I thought it was very educational, and I think that for a film that was back in the 1960s, right, that it would, as far as it could go. I mean, it was at the time where it was like, yeah, you can look at it and say blackface was wrong. Of course it's wrong. We know it's wrong. It was an more ignorant time, but for the film of itself, it was also kind of progressive in some regards toward race.
So I would suggest to somebody who wants to judge it for using that whitewashing, casting Alec Guinness as an Muslim prince, to think about it from the perspective of a script. The whitewashing didn't happen on the page of the script.
Right.
And so even if this character is physically depicted by an English actor, what are they saying? And I think we're really made to respect the characters one of them isn't whitewashed. It's an Arab kind of warlord played by a Puerto Rican. But he has some of my favorite lines in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the writing is there. The writing is progressive. I would argue that in many ways it's more progressive than you name it. I would compare like what's a modern day North African or Middle Eastern war Exodus. Film.
Well, we were talking about American Sniper briefly.
Oh, yeah. Before. Compare the progressiveness and the depiction of Arabs in Lawrence to American Sniper. Or a film like Black Hawk Down, the way they depict Somalians,
mm-hmm.
or any of these things, it's like...
Well, look, so there's also, when we're talking about race in the two films, there's two things to consider. There's two different discussions. You have what they're talking about race within the context of the film, like you were saying, the script, the actual story, the dialogue, like what's happening in the film, as if this is real life we're watching.
Right.
And then the context of the production of the film, or the acting, or who they... The unknown, like the unconscious decisions they made while making the film, that's whitewashing the story. Lawrence of Arabia, yeah, for sure. If there's any whitewashing in the film, I think it's the latter. It's like the unconscious, subtle maybe dialogue or subtle acting choices that they did that portray someone...
The idea of what a Western audience would want sure. from an Arab character. Right.
But the story itself, again, I wasn't born in this time period, so I don't necessarily have maybe the clout to say it, but this has to be ahead of its time, I feel like, Lawrence of Arabia, regarding race.
Right.
I haven't seen the other film that comes to my mind, which it's not quite a masterpiece of this level, but the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven. It's got that wonderful adventure pacing, true to life type characters. It's not necessarily, I'm not just looking for favorable depictions of different people outside of Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
More complex depictions.
Right.
Is what I'm looking
true
for.
True depictions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like that's what, you know, like that's, people are messy. You don't want a binary character that isn't real. That's demeaning in a way, even if it's a positive depiction.
Yeah, because the people were watching, those British, perhaps those British generals, or the people who are jeering Percy Fawcett and Lost City of Z, they want to see the world in binaries. They want to see the English and the savages. And one of them is advanced, and one of them is not. One of them has culture and knowledge. One of them does not.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I want to see a film that breaks that down. And I think Lawrence does.
I think it does too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I think it's because he gets to camp with him. He gets to become a part of them. And, you know, I think...
But does he?
That's the real question.
Well, he does and he doesn't. Because at some points, I think he's playing... You know, like he's having fun, like kind of like a child almost in some regard. I mean, even when he's in the film, at least when he's saying like, no, we're going to go to the deserts and it's going to be fun. We're going to have fun. I mean, that's also showing his like naivety toward the beginning of the film. But, you know, when he gets rid of his British clothes and he dons, you know, just like traditional Arab wear, and it's just like, all right, cool. So he's one of us. And then we see the evolution of, is he one of us? And it challenges him, and it continues to show how that character changes. Because, I mean, no one's going to 100% become that. And it actually shows the true-to-life conflict that occurred in real life that happened with the real guy, Lawrence, when he was in Africa. And, like, the fact that he fell in love with his own ego in some regard. He got taken down back to zero. He fell in love with his own, you know, his own hero's journey, and he got almost overly impassioned, and he got brought down to being humble again. And then refound himself, but he found a different version of himself. And that self is that evolved across the adventure.
He's got a weird journey in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of another person. For the sake of the discussion, I'll call him a character. Because okay. At this point, he is a character in a script. Yeah. I realize he's a real person. But this depiction...
He's a legend.
The journey is crazy. Yeah. Yeah, he's still a legend in the film. He still has this mythos around him. Yeah. but it's like this up and down and
well, the film takes a, like, you watch, you're watching the film, and as you're going, like, through the beginning, you are assuming this is going to be the typical almost, like, white savior coming in to save the day. Everything's going right.
He's going to teach the Arabs they need to know about the world and about warfare. And how to
win and how to be civilized human beings.
Right.
You know?
Well,
and the second half of the film is not that at all.
Nope.
And it kind of turns it on its head.
It's
in a, I think, an appropriate way too.
Well, we could divide the film into two parts.
Right.
And the intermission is well placed. The first part is an adventure film through and through.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. It's got the sweeping score. The danger comes from things like quicksand and the desert sun and a lack of water. The second part is a war film.
Yep.
And I don't mean to say it's brutal in the sense that, going back to Black Hawk Down, there's blood spewing everywhere, that kind of stuff. It's brutal in the way it's written and the turns the characters take. I was really floored rewatching it by how much of a war film it really was. It totally moved away from the feeling of adventure. The score is almost completely absent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like the most, like, savage part of it is not the slaughter scene, but the hospital scene was probably, like,
the consequence of war and...
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like the unknown. Like, I remember Kyle, you were talking about earlier, was, like, you don't know... Like, once you get in on a situation and you change how something, like, is happening, you're responsible for people's lives, basically. Like, you don't know, like, so they take over Damascus, basically, right? And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence leads them, convinces them to go to Damascus and
take the city
before the English, so that the Arabs are able to hold it.
And it falls apart. They can't agree amongst themselves of how to handle the situation and how to make the city
function.
Yeah, just survive, basically.
Right.
And they're not even paying attention that the hospital in the city that has hundreds of dying Turks...
It was thousands,
there you go, are just rotting away. And it's just so depressing. It's so sad that it's like you don't even think about it.
Yeah, how...
It's
when
real.
When have you ever seen a film deal, once a city's conquered, deal with having to manage the POWs to not being able to care for the people that you defeated?
Bridge on the River Kwai?
Not really.
A little bit. Well, like, I would say there's one, Band of Brothers, when the Cajun medic, where they dedicate an entire episode of showing, like, what the medic sees. And I thought that was a little bit more true to life in showing, like, hey, yeah, there's a guy screaming for his life as his leg is just spewing out blood and you have to watch him die.
But that's the horrors of war.
Well, I mean, it's showing the consequence.
It's not the aftermath.
Oh, like the aftermath.
Yeah, this is, they've taken a city. You've led men into battle. The responsibility doesn't stop there. I've never seen a film, it just doesn't come to mind, where it shows that there's a greater responsibility for leading men into war than just defeating the enemy. There's more than that. It doesn't stop. The scene may end in the film.
Yeah, it takes reality another step further and shows that.
And that's part of his whole journey.
Yeah, well, it shows it quickly. But I think is the ultimate grounding for, you know, you're not in Kansas anymore kind of moment for Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
It's, hey, you came in here ballyhooing about the desert going to be this rompous, pompous, you know, discovering your majesty and your adventure and your ego. No, it's like you're a man and you're in something that's bigger than yourself and you didn't take care of it. And here are your consequences.
You can't handle it.
And this is all on you and it's bigger than you and you done fucked up.
You've got 2,000 men rotting in a hospital with injuries and no water. There's no water running to this because you couldn't get your city functioning.
Yeah.
It's like they bring him down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's oddly satisfying, especially with... So if we were to use the term loosely, savage, someone who's bloodthirsty. I'm not trying to use it in a racial way, but there's the slaughter that happens before this shows that that piece of a person is in Lawrence as well.
Right, where he kind of like discovers that he...
loves killing.
Right, that he enjoys it. And he's a complicated character. Like, it scares him. He, when he initially discovers that, he tried to kind of retreat from continuing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's... that is so complicated and impressive. And it takes this kind of pacing of a film.
And length of time.
Yeah, to do something like that.
Right.
I'm just... I'm really having trouble thinking of other instances.
No, no. I think there's a reason why we watched a film from 1960 era in modern 2017. It's going to be watched in 2030 and 2040 and 2050. You know, it's going to be a classic, I think, for all time in cinema because of the breadth that it explored and how it explored it, the excellence of all of the elements of film coming together and, you know, showing this character's growth and destruction and rebirth and complicated, honest to truth person that he was.
Yeah, it was real problems and real conflicts and real issues of survival, even beyond just surviving in the desert, which that's what brings it into an adventure film for me. I like that there's real consequences for their actions. And then the depiction of Percy. So Lawrence is going through all these ups and downs in one war. How many years does this span? Like three? Perhaps probably three or four. Lost City of Z is this man's entire adult life. You see him from before he's obsessed with this issue, with the jungle, with the Lost City of Z, to where it's almost destroying his family, to World War
I. I was going to say, he's fighting in World War I. Which is the depiction of World War I.
Oh, gosh.
In that just... I don't want to say like small section of the film. I mean,
it's pretty much one sequence.
Yeah.
It's a taking of one trench to the other.
But that small section of the film, hands down, beat Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah. We all have
as depiction of war.
We all have that same exact thought
while in the theater. It. Yeah. We all, yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, yeah, just Hacksaw Ridge, it was a studio. You know, it was just a studio and how they shot it. They shot it close. They shot it tight with fast shutter speed, the excitement of war. Whereas in Lost City of Z, they took a step back, kind of how we see in the adventure film. They step back from the landscape to show the landscape and to show the wildness and just like the unforgivingness of it. They're in a different environment, but it's still just as dangerous, if not, of course, more so, actually. And it allows you to, appreciate on a much wider and... I don't want to say sadistic scale, but
it's not pretty.
The violence is visceral, and exactly. It's not pretty. It's not glossed up. It's sad, and there's no point of like your heart isn't beating out of excitement. It's beating out of worry. It's beating out of like you look at it almost with like a form of shame. I feel like, and then the Christ figure that's all battered and numb towards, just like this isn't a place for your civilization. This is civilized.
Mm-hmm.
You're calling these people savages. Look at you guys right now with your religious symbols of like protection and of your like epitome of perfection. You're just as bad as what you accuse these other people of. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so don't even. And then just taking him through all of that, that nonetheless, like after experiencing these traumas, the just tragedy that he had to experience, that he still is plagued by the jungle, and it's still a passion that he has to potentially explore, and then it gets reignited. I'm not going to say by who, because I think that's a good bit. I think that's one of the better surprises. I'd like to keep that all under wraps. But I think how his passion gets reignited, just how Lawrence's passion gets reignited, is what makes, you know, heroes heroes. You know, why do we fall down?
Jesus.
why do we fall down?
Well, okay, so I think... So I don't know if whoever's listening right now, I don't know if you listened to our previous, that was a couple episodes ago when we were talking about our best films of 2016, and we said our most disappointing film of the year was Hacksaw Ridge.
Episode 13.
The thing about that, and I think it's a good contrast between the two films, is Hacksaw, I think, does harm as far as understanding the context and like the situation that people were actually in war. Like, it, I think you understand less after watching Hacksaw. You might hear a story that you didn't know before that's important, but your understanding of like the true nature of the fighting is weakened. And I think with this film, even though it's not even that long, it was visceral, and I feel like you got the context of like how difficult or how like sad it really was. I don't know.
Yeah, sad is a good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to feel cathartic in the way that Hacksaw Ridge was.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Hacksaw Ridge, it turned it into an action sequence.
Yeah, it was nothing to be celebrated. I think that's all. It was meant, like, that depiction in Lost City of Z was men killing men. That's all it was. It was just the savagery that they looked down upon
senseless.
So much. Senseless.
And
just,
kind of like brought up that, like.
Yeah, and then like, you know, gassing each other and just like booby trapped, blowing dudes' legs off, like going through the mud, like trampling like people how they're still dying. And so, then in Hacksaw had like, we're shooting all these faceless Japanese people.
That's a big thing too there. You've got white versus white people.
Right.
In the trenches of Europe. And in Hacksaw Ridge, I mean, it's not whitewashing, and it's like a step backward racially.
It is, yeah.
It's an odd kind, I don't want to say necessarily insulting depiction of the Japanese, but it's very one-dimensional. And
they were zombies from...
who held guns by
you guys. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
They were like a flood, you know, they weren't people. They were an element that you were fighting. I don't know.
Well, like, no, it reminded me of like the, it's kind of silly to say, but the Avengers film, how it was just like, oh, what are we fighting right now? It's like, oh, a bunch of like robots that are coming through another dimension,
mm-hmm.
these faceless mutants. And there was just nothing to it.
It's just
it.
Like an insert evil or insert opposition here.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just an obstacle to put in the way to overcome. And a lot of people, because I've discussed Hacksaw, like a lot of people when we were on set on X-Men, people didn't understand like why we didn't like Hacksaw. And I was trying to explain to them like how the Japanese were just being used as targets to let the plot go forward.
Yeah, they were definitely targets.
They were definitely targets. and I guess
they were
like,
stormtroopers.
And I think it just goes to show you how the trouble of race in film as an artifact is still very much so alive and still very much so needs to be analyzed and aware that it's still an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, from 1960 to 2017 or 2016 when Hacksaw came out. So I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's like you need to.
You're better off going to watch Lawrence.
Yeah.
Is what we're saying.
In summation.
Go ahead.
In summation. Hacksaw, shit the bed. Don't watch it. But Lawrence of Arabia, hey, I picked that copy up, you know what I'm saying? But as far as, talking about Lawrence of Arabia, Lost City of Z, characters, technical, anything else that we feel like we left on the table?
I got one point. It's not really a good one, but...
Well, shut the fuck up.
You had a good edit point there when I kind of laughed and we let it trail off a little bit. So jump back in strong with whatever your thought is.
That's what I was doing. Wait.
No, it was just kind of like, I felt like we were still kind of trailing in. It was like, we're going to.
Okay. So yeah, it's not really like a necessarily a good point, but the one thing I didn't like about Lawrence of Arabia, when this says a lot, because it's maybe the one thing that sticks out to me, is the eyeliner.
Yeah.
Just.
They really wanted to bring out his blue eyes.
They really did.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing with that is I remember I was sitting there with my phone and I was like, look at this, like bullshit movie, and just like, you know, this white dude coming in wearing a white robe and all, just like all this symbolism. Oh, I looked it up. Oh, okay, he was blonde with blue eyes and did wear a white robe. Okay. And I was just like, I thought this movie was being really racist for a second, but look at that. Like, you read a book and all of a sudden you know something.
Yeah, it's got a, you could probably look at a couple other things, like maybe some of the interiors that, I mean, and it's pretty well designed. Other than that, it's kind of striking that maybe the only thing holding it back from being this modern depiction is the eyeliner.
No, yeah. That was a joke for sure, but you know, like,
it does draw your eye occasionally. It does. Yeah. It does. Yeah. And the performances can be a little old fashioned. He came from more of a theatrical kind of background.
Yeah, it had that. It did have that tone. But honestly,
you, like, let it go after a while.
Yeah, after an hour, you get kind of used to it. Like, I mean, sometimes I'm like, I just don't understand anymore. And I'm just like, okay. But I don't know. I liked it. It was charming in its respect. I liked it still.
Yeah, and it kind of sets him apart too.
Mm-hmm.
Even as a character, the performance is way more theatrical. And
because he's an eccentric guy.
Yeah, eccentric is a good word for it.
Yeah. He's kind of silly. I mean, as far as adventure films, I mean, do you have any closing comments on when, like, what does it get? What do adventure films give us? And what should you keep looking out for?
Well, I've got two notes. I'll respond to your prompt there. As saying, I think it's about struggle. I think there's, even if they don't know why they want something, or even perhaps what they want, there is an external obstacle that brings out the character. And it's what molds them and changes them into what will either, perhaps they'll destroy themselves, or they'll reach whatever it is they desire, or perhaps it's always out of reach. Whatever it is, there's something external that, even like in the case of Trax, she's struggling with something internal, and she goes to find external conflict to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the environment is going to play a very important role. It could be multiple environments, but usually it's like, especially in these cases, we've got the desert and we've got the jungle.
It has to be a character of some sort in the film.
The setting should play an important role in that discovery. And then one of my final closing notes, another reason I was so impressed with Lost City of Z, is I usually despise biopics. I think usually films will pick a famous person, like Long Walk to Freedom, the Nelson Mandela movie. I hated it. They try to cram everything in. They end up getting so many details wrong or mixing up events. It's like they try to jam so much in that it's just a mistake.
Right.
It shouldn't be made. Just go read the biography or the autobiography. But in this case, perhaps it's because they took their time with it. Mm-hmm. They didn't try to cram it into 2 hours or an hour and a half.
Very much like how Steve Jobs was, that, I mean, it was certain highlighted points in the moments. And they picked their moments within with Mr. Fawcett's life very well,
mm-hmm.
just like the Steve Jobs film did. But I would say within an adventure film, I think we can always identify a lot with it, because there's something that you just admire so terribly much towards, like, that the person that has the chest that's two times as big, they have this boldness and bravery that kind of speaks to, just something that I think that's deep down inside of us, of wanting to discover and wanting to explore.
They've got passion.
Exactly.
It's like, don't you want passion in your life?
I love you so much, Kyle. Oh, God. But yeah, I love the passion of it all. And, you know, that's why I really like adventure films. What about you, Neil?
It's not really as far as notes, but more of like, honestly, I haven't really watched many adventure films. When we came up with this topic, it's kind of a, not that it's a weak area of mine, but I don't know much about adventure films. I feel like I haven't thought about them necessarily as like a genre for me to like pay attention to. But for sure now, like talking about it and kind of getting a different understanding of what it means to be an adventure film.
Mm-hmm.
It's on your radar now.
It's on my radar for sure.
Well, and
it's more than just on my radar.
But safe to say, adventure films are certainly something to pay attention to. There's something that are significant within the whole repertoire of cinema. Let us know what adventure films that you guys love, but I don't know. I love talking about it. I would say definitely watch Lost City of Z, Lawrence of Arabia, and I don't know. Let us know what you guys would recommend.
Especially me.
Especially you. Well.
Well, speaking of recommendations.
Well, so for recommendations, one movie that I love on a deep level because of the soundtrack, because of it's a period, because it's a period piece, deals with Native Americans, Daniel Day-Lewis, and that's Last Mohicans. It's a based off of a novel by James Fenimore Cooper. I remember my family used to listen to it, the soundtrack, just while we ate dinner, because I grew up with soundtracks. That's what we listen to soundtracks, like just by chance when we dined. And I remember Last Mohicans, just like, it has a resounding just soundtrack, and it has a gravitas and a pace that I just love and would highly recommend. And it delivers so well.
It's an epic film.
Oh yeah. Also, Last Mohicans is directed by Michael Mann. But so if you're a Michael Mann fan, if you like period pieces, if you like Native Americans or Daniel Day-Lewis, check out Last Mohicans.
And if you are a Michael Mann fan, you're gonna like this episode because my recommendation is also a Michael Mann film. Because I just recently saw for the first time Heat, which is his crime drama action. It's a classic. It definitely is like kind of set the tone. It's a movie that's been copied constantly since
Bad Boys 2.
Yes, Bad Boys 2. No, the opening scene in The Dark Knight is clearly a Heat reference. It's an homage to Heat. The movie stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Val Kilmer.
What made you like Heat?
It's like pretty epic. It's a huge epic scale. So when I went and saw it, they also had like a Q&A with Michael Mann, like a live Q&A, which was pretty cool. The kind of like talking about and, you know, hearing backstory of it, it was kind of one of the first action films to like, or crime films to utilize realism as much as it did. Like the intent on it was like, let's get real. How would real people react?
They're not caricatures of thieves.
Right.
They're trying to make actual criminals. They're smart. They're professionals.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know. That's what I really liked about it.
So Heat, Michael Mann, Neil approved, Cinepile approved.
Yep.
Kyle, it comes down to you. What do you have?
The last recommendation of the episode. That's what I have. This was a film my grandfather shared with me. Aww. It was one of his favorites. It goes right in line with this entire episode. It's The Treasure of the Sierra Madre from 1948. John Huston film starring Humphrey Bogart. It's got some...
Wait, what
It's
year?
Definitely a little dated. 1948.
Okay.
Classic adventure. Premise does not pull the punches, especially for the time. A couple Americans go into the Mexican mountains searching for gold.
Why should I watch it? What'd you love about it?
It's got the feeling that there was some inspiration from this in Indiana Jones, except without more of the fantastical elements. It's still grounded, but it's also symbolic. You can just distill that image of gold down into greed. Right. That's what it represents. And so it becomes, whereas like the jungle was in the pottery, all of these, finding that was Percy's obsession. It's like, this is an obsession that you know does not lead anywhere good.
Right.
Yeah. This does
Most
not...
Most gold stories don't.
Yeah, it does. And so it's got that kind of inevitable, I don't want to say tragedy about it, but it's like, you know where this is going, and it's classic.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that set the standard for the adventure films of the time. And it's John Huston, one of the great American directors. So if black that's not reason enough.
Is it black and white?
It is black and white.
Black and white. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Yes.
1948 film. I had The Last Mohicans. Neil had Heat. Check them out. They're Cinepile approved, folks. Well, safe to say that that's the close of the episode. It's been a hot minute. I think we may be a little rusty, but I think we delivered a hell of an episode. What do you guys say?
Crooked.
Ow.
No, I love it. We could keep talking.
Yeah,
about
I think the only troubling thing is that it was tough not to say too much.
There's so much information to be held.
I would say the easiest way, just watch them. Check out Lawrence of Arabia. Check out The Lost City of Z, and also check out Cinepile Podcast. If you can, like us, leave a comment or leave a review for us on iTunes, because that helps us out a lot. Guys, I appreciate it if you made it all the way to the end of the podcast episode. I've been Cooper Carr.
Neil Anderson.
And Kyle Montgomery.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a good one.
This is some serious gourmet shit. Yes.